Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. The European Union said renewed fighting in eastern Ukraine this week is the most serious breach of the ceasefire that was agreed to in February by the warring sides. Speaking to reporters in Brussels Thursday, the EU's Executive Commission spokeswoman called on the warring sides to respect the Minsk ceasefire agreement reached in February by France, Germany, Russia, Ukraine, and pro-Russia separatists. The agreement envisions a ceasefire and withdrawal of troops and heavy weapons, leading to a lasting solution to the conflict in eastern Ukraine. Hong Kong is holding a candlelight vigil to commemorate the anniversary of China's 1989 crackdown on pro-democracy protesters in Tiananmen Square. Thousands of people packed Hong Kong's Victoria Park for the rally Thursday, which this year takes place just a couple of days ahead of a key vote to determine the territory's political future. Mainland authorities do not allow public discussion of the incident. Chinese authorities also rounded up key pro-democracy figures before the anniversary, while internet censors worked overtime to scrub social media of any references to the brutal crackdown. The United Nations appealed to the international community for $500 million Thursday to maintain its operations in conflict-stricken Iraq, where a top official says humanitarian aid will be scaled back dramatically without further funding. Lisa Grand, the UN humanitarian coordinator for Iraq, says the financial boost is needed immediately to provide services to 5.6 million Iraqis until the end of the year. The organization is asking for $497 million to pay for shelter, food, and water for the next 6 months. This is VOA News. Former FIFA Vice President Jack Warner says he has proof of financial dealings involving the organization's governing body and the 2010 general elections in his home country, Trinidad and Tobago. Warner, who has been charged in the FIFA corruption scandal, said in a televised address late Wednesday he has documents and checks that link FIFA with the Caribbean island nation's 2010 election. The U.S. Justice Department last week charged 14 people with racketeering, wire fraud and money laundering, and a scheme prosecutors say involved sports media executives. Nigeria's president has said his government will leave no stone unturned in dealing with all cases of human rights abuses. It follows the release of a shocking report from Amnesty International, which alleges widespread torture, abuse, and killing of more than 8,000 prisoners during the military's offensive against the terror group Boko Haram. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Amnesty International gathered dozens of brutal videos and images showing abuses and killings apparently carried out by the Nigerian armed forces. In some, prisoners are beaten to death. In others, they are shot and thrown into open graves. Amnesty interviewed more than 400 victims, eyewitnesses and senior members of the security forces. Most of the prisoner deaths occurred during detention, says Amnesty's Daniel Eyre.
We found that more than 7,000 people have died in military custody in northeast Nigeria in some of the most appalling conditions imaginable. They died of starvation, of thirst, as a result of lack of access to medical care. Many were tortured.
Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
An explosion at a gas station in Ghana's capital has killed some 90 people who had gathered for shelter during torrential rains there. Ghanaian officials confirmed the accident Thursday. Reports from the scene said the explosion and resulting fire took place at a gas station and then spread to nearby buildings. Officials said local hospitals have taken as many bodies as they can accommodate. The search for more victims is continuing, and officials have warned that the death toll is likely to rise. Myanmar immigration authorities say Bangladesh has agreed to take back 200 boat people rescued off the Myanmar coast last month. A total of 208 refugees, all men, and 11 crew members were aboard the ship, which had been at sea for months. All but 8 of the men declared they were from Bangladesh and are being held at a detention camp in Myanmar, just a few kilometers from the border with Bangladesh. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Nigeria's president has said his government will leave no stone unturned in dealing with all cases of human rights abuses. It follows the release of a shocking report from Amnesty International, which alleges widespread torture, abuse and killing of more than 8,000 prisoners during the military's offensive against the terror group Boko Haram.
That's Henry Ridgewell reporting from London. Details coming up.
Also, an explosion at a gas station in Ghana's capital kills 90 people, and a government spokesman for Burundi says the country's parliamentary and presidential elections have been postponed.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Guinea in our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the Associated Press says an explosion at a gas station in Ghana's capital has killed 90 people who had gathered for shelter during torrential rains. Ghanaian officials confirmed the accident today. Reports from the scene said the explosion and resulting fire took place at a gas station and spread to nearby buildings near the Kwame Nkrumah Circle in central Accra. The cause of the explosion is still not clear. Officials say local hospitals have taken as many bodies as they can accommodate. The search for more victims continues, and officials have warned that the death toll is likely to rise. Fire police and armed forces and emergency services personnel are at the site to conduct rescue operations. A crowd has gathered at the site despite an official request that they stay away.
Television footage and photos of the accident site show graphic images of charred bodies and vehicles and churning waters in nearby streets. President John Mahama has visited the scene of the accident along with the mayor of Accra and member of parliament. The president told the reporters the loss of life is catastrophic and vowed such an incident will not be repeated. Accra has suffered 2 days of heavy rains that have flooded homes, caused power outages, and left some roads impassable. Officials said the toll from the accident is high because people had gathered at the fuel station and nearby buildings to escape the floods. The flooding has also hampered rescue operations.
In Burundi, government spokesman Willy Nyamitwe says the country's parliamentary and presidential elections have been postponed. Legislative elections were to take place tomorrow, while presidential polls were scheduled for June 26th. According to the Associated Press Wire Service, Nyamitwe says the Electoral Commission is expected to propose new dates for the polls. On Sunday, the East African community asked the government to postpone the elections for a month and a half and to ensure that there is a peaceful atmosphere for the polls. Regular protests have broken out in the country's capital, Bujumbura, since President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term. Opponents say the move is not constitutional.
Nigeria's president has said his government will leave no stone unturned in dealing with all cases of human rights abuses. It follows the release of a shocking report from Amnesty International, which alleges widespread torture, abuse, and killing of more than 8,000 prisoners during the military's offensive against the terror group Boko Haram. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Amnesty International gathered dozens of brutal videos and images showing abuses and killings apparently carried out by the Nigerian armed forces. In some, prisoners are beaten to death. In others, they are shot and thrown into open graves. Amnesty interviewed more than 400 victims, eyewitnesses and senior members of the security forces. Most of the prisoner deaths occurred during detention, says Amnesty's Daniel Eyre.
We found that more than 7,000 people have died in military custody in northeast Nigeria in some of the most appalling conditions imaginable. They died of starvation, of thirst, as a result of lack of access to medical care. Many were tortured.
Amnesty's evidence also points to the widespread extrajudicial killing of prisoners. Some were hung on poles and suspended over fires. Others were thrown into pits, had their throats cut, or were shot.
More than 1,200 men and boys were unlawfully killed by the Nigerian military. That includes cases like what happened after the Giwa barracks attack, where more than 640 recaptured detainees were executed in one day. And our report shows that the people at the top of the Nigerian military knew about these crimes and didn't take action to stop them.
Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari gave his first reaction to the report on Twitter, saying his administration will leave no stone unturned, in his words, to promote the rule of law and deal with all cases of human rights abuses. On a visit Wednesday to neighbouring Niger to discuss Boko Haram, Mr. Buhari pledged a new strategy to fight the terror group. President Buhari said he renewed his commitment to chase Boko Haram up to its last trenches to obliterate it. 5 years of the evil presence of this sect is enough, he said, adding that Nigerian soldiers have suffered a lot of defeats, but it is not the moment to criticise. Furthermore, he said, we are going to mobilise our best forces to attack this sect. The Amnesty report names five senior officers who it says should face investigation. But Nigeria's Director of Defence Information, Major General Chris Olukolade, accused Amnesty of trying to blackmail the military and said the officers accused had no reason to indulge in the allegation made against them. But the evidence is compelling, says Daniel Eyre.
In fact, at one point they commissioned a report which showed the appalling conditions in detention, the disease that was causing these deaths. And yet they didn't take action to put an end to these deaths. And that's why we're saying they need to be investigated for their responsibility.
The United States, which had strained ties with President Buhari's predecessor, Goodluck Jonathan, has signalled its readiness to expand military cooperation in the fight against Boko Haram. But analysts say Nigeria's Western allies will want the allegations of war crimes to be fully investigated. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Thank you, Henry. The Associated Press reports that 22 people were killed yesterday in Maiduguri in a rush hour attack by Boko Haram. Efforts to rescue people wounded in the attack, which took place in Baga Road, were slowed by sandstorm and rains. The attacks follow President Muhammadu Buhari's announcement that he would move the command center in the fight against the terrorists from Abuja to Maiduguri. This week, Buhari has been traveling to two countries helping to supply troops to fight the Islamic extremists, Niger and Chad. He said he would cooperate fully with both neighbors who had complained that a lack of cooperation was impeding the fight.
Speaking in Niger, Buhari said his country's army would take over from soldiers from Niger occupying towns liberated from Boko Haram. He said Nigeria's allies would provide weapons and help rebuild infrastructure destroyed in the fighting. Yesterday, the Nigerian Defense Minister announced that Major General Tukur Yusuf Bartai will be in charge of the multinational force fighting the Islamist extremists. The effort has been led by Chad. Niger President said yesterday that a new multinational force will begin operations in a few weeks. They will include nearly 9,000 troops from Nigeria, Niger, Chad, Cameroon, and Benin. The troops will be deployed to fight Boko Haram in the Lake Chad region.
In Uganda, a hateful message spread over the popular messaging platform WhatsApp has prompted debate over policing social media. President Yoweri Museveni has called for the creators of the message to be arrested, but some are saying prosecution could set a dangerous precedent. Elizabeth Pula has more from Kampala.
When a hateful audio message spread over WhatsApp ridiculing the Bahima people of Western Uganda, it sparked anger from President Yoweri Museveni. In response to the audio, Mr. Museveni released a nearly 15-minute-long video calling for the arrest of those who had created the message. Directly addressing the perpetrators behind the audio, he calls them fools and enemies looking to divide the nation.
Abakare,
Yet the president's video has caused its own mixed reaction. The language Mr. Museveni speaks in the video is Ranyankole, spoken in southwestern Uganda. This left many wondering why an anti-tribalism message would be delivered in a language specific to his particular tribe. Some also balked at President Museveni's suggestion that anybody who had shared the WhatsApp message was complicit in ethnic hate. But many Ugandans support the clampdown on ethnic hate. Popular TV panelist Colin Asimwe says tribal division in Uganda is still strong and cannot be allowed to spiral.
Because of what's happened in the region, I mean, like, if you see what happened in South Sudan, because that was one ethnicity rising up against another, there was Kenya, there was, you know, Burundi, and then there was Rwanda. So it's so sensitive. I mean, like, it's so sensitive. And not even just, like, the civilian population like you and me, it just even like the security services and the government. The last time it tried to happen was with the Kony and Northern Uganda. So there's a lot of work. Like, there's so much to worry about.
Ugandan law bans the promotion of sectarian hate. Although there has never been a conviction for this crime, because of vague wording, the law remains contentious. Some suggest it has been used primarily against journalists and opposition candidates. A lawyer who has worked on online media laws, Peter Magela, says the law on sectarian hate is applicable in this case, but he says applying the law to social media could be a problem.
What I find as a challenge is really not the what the law says. Mm-hmm. The challenge is how to enforce what the law says. How to identify the originator is a very difficult thing. Once you identify the originator, how to choose who to sue, because publication would mean anyone who shared, anyone who posted on his or her Facebook, anyone who possibly liked. It becomes so many people who got into that. The problem we've had in this country is many times people, there's some sort of selective justice for selective criminal justice. So it's like if there's a political opponent doing that, the law would catch up with him.
Although the WhatsApp audio in question was clearly aimed at demeaning the behemoth, mitigating hate speech and freedom of expression in the lead-up to the 2016 presidential elections could prove to be a delicate balance between protecting the nation's unity and clamping down on social media. Elizabeth Pola, VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. An explosion at the gas station in Ghana's capital has killed 90 people. A government spokesman from Burundi, the country's parliamentary and president elections, he said, have been postponed. And Nigeria's president has said his government will leave no stone unturned in dealing with all cases of human rights abuses. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The UN's International Labour Organization, ILO, estimates that there are 20.9 million victims of human trafficking worldwide, with children comprising about 25%. In 2014, the ILO estimated that forced labour generates $150 billion in profits annually worldwide. The organization also says an estimated 1 out of 6 endangered runaways reported to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children were likely child sex trafficking victims. Sister Judith Sheridan of the Marist Missionary Sisters in San Diego, California, is a nun and nurse in her mid-70s. She has worked as a missionary around the world and educates teens on the danger of falling prey to human traffickers. She said the modern-day form of slavery, including forced sex, labor, and organ donation, is the second greatest moneymaker in the world.
Human trafficking depends on people having to give a service, either a sexual service or labor of some sort, because of threats or coercion are fraud, and it has become a major $34 billion industry globally, and it's driven by supply and demand. And you have to ask yourself, of course, why there's such a demand for sexual favors and for cheap labor. In the area of the sexual favors, there's a whole hypersexualized culture that we're living in. And the internet has been a major, major part of the demand.
Now, of course, human trafficking is prevalent throughout the world. What information do you have regarding Africa?
For Africa, it's the same as any place globally. There's a very huge network of recruiters and transporters and buyers and sellers. But in Africa, there's a large demand for organs trafficking. It's people who are being bought and sold for their organs, for organ transplants. It's a big industry in some of the parts of Africa more than others.
How do children become victims of human trafficking?
Children become victims because of desperation very often. For instance, when you have these tsunamis or where you're having wars, you know, the children become orphans or they're unsupervised or they're going to be easily a prey to being taken and used for trafficking. In the United States, it's interesting that commercial sexual exploitation of children takes place everywhere, of course, and the age where it's mostly happening is between 12 to 14. And these children are being recruited through the internet. They're being recruited actually outside their middle schools or their high schools, in the malls. So it's wherever you're going to find children. You're going to find these predators who are looking to charm them, recruit them, deceive them.
And because they do operate in such a covert fashion, how do you fight this type of crime?
Well, there are many levels of society where it has to be fought. For instance, in schools, there has to be curriculums that are going to alert parents and children to this danger and help to get them on board. Parents have to know what's happening with their children and who they're talking to on the internet. The police and the law enforcement, immigration, Homeland Security, FBI, they're all more and more aware of this problem. They have vice squads, they have units looking for trafficked victims. But you see, it takes so long to follow up on an ad, say for an underage minor being prostituted, and then you have to be able to follow that pimp. You're going to have to be able to catch the persons. You're going to have to be able to bring them to court to be able to make a good case against them. And it's a very long process, labor intensive. So for such a huge global problem, you're only getting a few of the actors, a few of the criminals. So it's something like has to be done on a much more broad level, raising of consciousness in people. We need gender kind of a respect, a new kind of a look at how we're going to raise our boys and girls. I mean, it's not a simple answer, and it's going to take a lot of people looking at how we're living and how we're looking at our respect for male, female, how we're going to be able to help each other and help our children.
Sister Judith Sheridan is a nun with the Marist Missionary Sisters. She spoke with me from San Diego, California.
This Saturday, June 6th, hundreds of citizens in 30 countries will have a chance to voice their concerns and learn about climate change. The comments and opinions will be considered when the next climate change conference is held in Paris in December. VOA's Jody Campbell reports.
The citizen consultation and deliberation process is called Worldwide Views. It's an effort to raise awareness about climate change and other issues. Organizers say it's better suited for discussions on environmental matters than traditional surveys or focus groups, and that it will help close the widening gap between citizens and policymakers. Worldwide Views is described as a global citizen consultation that provides decision makers with a unique insight on complex governance issues that are debated and negotiated at global venues, such as the UN. It's been in use for climate conferences since 2009. University of Helsinki adjunct professor Mikko Krask has studied the consultation process. He says while supported by the UN, the consultations are actually organized by the Worldwide Views Initiative.
It's a network of research institutes, environmental and other NGOs, assessment institutes, and maybe some ministries as well. But the coordinator, real coordinator, is Danish Board of Technology that used to be a parliamentarian body that provided advice to Danish Parliament.
The day-long event in 80 countries features groups of 100 randomly selected people discussing major issues facing the climate. Krask says the process is superior to surveys and focus groups because of the high level of ignorance among the public about environmental issues. For example, a poll shows only 44% of Europeans know the meaning of biodiversity. A simple definition is the variety of different types of life found in specific geographic locations. He says, if citizens lack sufficient information, how can you survey their opinions?
Questions and issues of global negotiations are really complicated and not available for publics to start reflecting without any kind of background information. So you cannot survey what folks should think about problems of biodiversity.
So the group meetings will also be used to raise awareness. Professor Krask is co-editor of a new book entitled Governing Biodiversity Through Democratic Deliberation. The book contains evaluations by 30 international researchers on the role of the citizen consultation process in environmental policy.
Questions and issues of global negotiations are really complicated and not available for publics to start reflecting without any kind of background information. So you cannot survey what folks should think about problems of biodiversity.
The book does find some problems with the Worldwide Views consultations. Researchers say the method often relies too heavily on numerical information while ignoring local perspectives. Krask says that since the UN is interested in more democratic decision-making, the local perspectives of different countries should be integrated more closely into global policymaking. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best. right here on VOA Africa.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. An explosion at a gas station in Ghana's capital kills 90 people. A government spokesman from Burundi says the country's parliamentary and presidential elections have been postponed. And Nigeria's president said his government will leave no stone unturned in dealing with all cases of human rights abuses. Coming up, we'll have music from Guinea, and in our feature segment, we look into the new political party recently launched in Zimbabwe's capital. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're beginning with pro basketball.
Kim, the National Basketball Association finals tip off later Thursday night in the western U.S. city of Oakland, California, where the Golden State Warriors will host the Cleveland Cavaliers in Game 1 of the Best of 7 Championship Series. Basketball fans are eager to see how Golden State's Stephen Curry, the league's reigning most valuable player, does against Cleveland's LeBron James, a four-time MVP. Now, the two players probably won't guard each other much during the finals because they play different positions. Curry is likely to be matched against Kyrie Irving, Cleveland's three-time All-Star guard, who, like Curry, is an excellent ball handler. In fact, LeBron says they're two of the greatest ball handlers in NBA history.
They are two of the best ball handlers that this league has ever seen. Their ability to make shots off the handle, Steph's ability to use his handle to get off shots, three step backs, Kyrie's ability to be crafty, use his ability to get into the lane and make shots. You know, when you have a handle like that, you can pretty much get any shot you want, and they both show you that. With their speed, their change of pace, their ball handling, and then their ability to shoot the ball. They can absolutely just shoot the rock. And when you have a handle like that, it just keeps the defender, keeps the second line of defense, the third line of defense just so off kilter because you don't quite know exactly where they're going to be.
LeBron James has a lot of respect for Steph Curry, the sharp shooting guard for the Warriors, and the feeling is mutual.
I mean, he's a great talent. He seems to be able to get to anywhere he wants to on the floor. He's a gamer. You know, he's going to be ready for big moments. And he's got a motor that you always got to be ready. There's no time that you can kind of take a possession off against him. So you always got to be locked into your game plan. You're not going to, you know, totally shut him down. I don't think that's been done before.
Steph Curry says LeBron James has given him some tips during his six-year NBA career, and he remembers one moment during his rookie season in 2009-2010.
Most memorable conversation I had with him was after, I think, a game in Cleveland my rookie year. And they beat us that night, but he pulled me off to the side right before I left the court and kind of, he understood the situation I was in as a rookie. We were not a very good team at the time. I was trying to find my way as a player and basically just said that one thing you control is your preparation every single game, how you're going to find ways to get better and just having tunnel vision. No matter what's going on around you, you can control, you know, your effort every game, your professionalism and just what you do day in, day out to get yourself ready. And there's going to be a time when it's all going to kind of work out because you'll be ready for that moment. So not to get caught up in the drama of what was going on in my team or the situation, because you hopefully have a long career.
That's Golden State Warriors basketball star Steph Curry talking about LeBron James. Curry and the Warriors will host LeBron and the Cavaliers later Thursday night in Oakland, California, in Game 1 of the NBA Finals. Australian big man Andrew Bogut is the starting center for the Warriors, and he's backed up by Festus Ezeli, the pride of Benin City, Nigeria, and the subject of the latest Sunny Side of Sports blog post. VOA intern and guest blogger Jonah Haskell writes how Festus, then a young teenager, came here to the United States where he learned the game of basketball. You can read the blog post at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. This VOA programming note, I greatly enjoyed being guest host this week on our hashtag VOA TV program, which focused on Special Olympics. Special Olympics is the world's largest sports organization for children and adults with intellectual disabilities, providing training and competitions for almost 5 million athletes in about 170 countries. One of the guests on hashtag VOA was Tim Shriver, whose late mother, Eunice Kennedy Shriver, founded Special Olympics almost 50 years ago. Tim is the chairman of Special Olympics, the same position his late father, Sergeant Shriver, held with the organization. I asked Tim Shriver, how did your parents inspire you to carry the torch of Special Olympics?
The biggest lesson they taught me, and I think they taught it to so many other people, is that it was really important to commit yourself to something that will change the world, make it a little bit better. Even if your contribution is small, give your best to making the world a little bit better. The second thing they taught is you can have fun doing that. It doesn't always have to be hard work and labor. It can also be joy. And my mother in particular believed that sport was a way that we could teach one another very important lessons. Lessons about trust, about confidence, lessons about teamwork and camaraderie, lessons about learning to understand and accept one another as teammates. And so we have in Special Olympics this great combination, I think it's almost unmatchable, of being gladiators for justice, fighting against intolerance, fighting against the neglect that exists around the world for people with intellectual differences, but at the same time doing it by having a good time. Playing our way into the hearts and minds of millions and millions of people around the world. And by playing our way into their hearts, we hope encouraging them to be more tolerant and accepting and welcoming of all their brothers and sisters who are different.
Tim, I mentioned the broad reach of Special Olympics. It goes all over the world.
Yeah.
Can you talk about growth in, say, Africa and Asia?
Well, we have now almost 5 million athletes who participate at least once during the year in a Special Olympics event in their community. 1 million in China, 1 million in India, over 100,000 in sub-Saharan Africa and around the world, all throughout the Middle East in countries that have struggled with war like Afghanistan and Rwanda, countries that have fast-growing economies like China and India, countries with older civilizations like Japan and Korea. All of these places have welcomed the athletes of Special Olympics because I think the unifying power of sport, everybody loves to play, no matter what age, but also the compelling nature of the challenge to change. So we're lucky to boast a movement that was, yes, born in the United States, conceived by an American woman, athlete, which is rare in the annals of great social change movements, but now is owned and shared really by the entire world, a world that has embraced volunteerism, embraced the power of sport, and embraced the civil rights movement that is this movement for people with intellectual differences who still are so misunderstood.
We saw that torch relay at the opening of the program, and I know one Special Olympics athlete in particular, you kind of gave a shout-out for as part of that relay.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Well, Marty, I carried the flame for Marty Sheets. Marty Sheets died just about 10 days ago. He was a young man born with Down syndrome in North Carolina. He grew up in a time when nobody would have expected to see him in a village or in a town or in a city, in a school. His mother and father pushed him to be included. He ended up being selected because of his swimming to go to the first ever Special Olympics Games in 1968. Again, getting on a plane for the first time. These are all new experiences. Marty might have been an uncommon sight in his time, but he did something equally uncommon, which is he changed the way people saw Down syndrome. Marty helped people not to see Down syndrome, but to see Marty. And at the age of 62, his death marked the end of a great pioneer of justice and social change. And he inspires me every day, even now.
That's Tim Shriver, the chairman of Special Olympics, and he spoke with me at our Voice of America studios here in Washington. And mark your calendars, the Special Olympics World Games will be held in Los Angeles, California, from July 25th to August 2nd. The 2015 FIFA Women's World Cup football tournament will kick off in Canada on Saturday. The opening match will take place in the Western Canadian city of Edmonton, where host Canada will take on China. The tournament features an expanded field of 24 teams this year, up from 16 in previous years. This means that 8 new teams will be making their first Women's World Cup appearances, including 2 African squads. Cameroon and Ivory Coast will look to make a mark in their inaugural tournament, but their work will be cut out for them as the Ivorians are grouped with world number one Germany, while Cameroon will have to contend with reigning world champion Japan in Group C. World Cup veterans Nigeria are also in a tough group, Group G. It includes 3 teams that are ranked number 10 or higher, Australia, Sweden, and the 2-time world champion United States. The Super Falcons of Nigeria, who have appeared in the last 7 Women's World Cups, are hoping their experience can help them duplicate or even surpass their great 1999 performance. That year, the Nigerians became the only African women's team to reach a World Cup quarterfinal. Ivory Coast will play their opening game against Germany on Sunday, while Cameroon and Nigeria will begin their campaigns the next day on Monday. Cameroon plays Ecuador, while Nigeria will take on Sweden. Moving across the Pacific and deep down under, the FIFA Under-20 World Cup continued Thursday in New Zealand with 4 games of Group E and F action. Nigerians Isaac Success and Godwin Savior lived up to their names, combining to score 3 goals as the Flying Eagles soared to a 4-0 win over North Korea. This puts the African youth champions on the brink of a quarterfinal appearance. Meanwhile, Fiji produced one of the biggest upsets in world football history as they beat Honduras 3-0. This was the island nation's first ever win at a FIFA tournament on any level. Germany, on the other hand, surprised no one with a 3-0 victory over Uzbekistan, and Brazil came from behind to defeat Hungary 2-1. With 6 points each, the Germans and the Brazilians follow the USA and Portugal as the 3rd and 4th teams to clinch quarterfinal berths at New Zealand 2015. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, we look into the new political party recently launched in Zimbabwe's capital. And next, a U.S. trade provision that lets thousands of products from African countries enter the U.S. without paying taxes. But first, some music. Here is Sion Kamara of Guinea with Umu. Sayon Kamara of Guinea with Umu.
Well, a new political party was recently launched in Zimbabwe's capital. The Zimbabweans United for Democracy Party, or ZUNDE, was formed in the diaspora 2 years ago. Members include former High Court Justice Benjamin Peraza. Irvin Chifera of VOA's Zimbabwe Service reports.
Speaking at the launch in the capital, party president Farah Imbira said his deputy, Justice Peraza, will represent the party in New Zealand, while the party has already structures in Britain, US, Germany, and South Africa. Mbira, who described himself as a former liberation fighter, said, though formed in the diaspora, it is now time to introduce a different brand of politics in Zimbabwe.
For a long time, we have been patient. We have put our faith in other movements, but they too have let us down. Enough is enough. The torch must now pass to a new generation.
Mbira said ZUNDE will work with like-minded people to democratize the electoral process in Zimbabwe. He said while most Zimbabweans were fed up with President Robert Mugabe and his ZANU-PF party policies, they are equally frustrated by the opposition, which he described as inept.
People have lost all confidence in the Mugabe regime, but cannot recommit to a token opposition, which has also lost its way. ZUNDE fills the leadership vacuum created by a corrupt government and an ineffective and compromised opposition riddled with ZANU-PF informers and CIO agents.
Harare youth Romeo Muswe said ZUNDE was a part of the future.
This part has got direction, because like recently our future has been stolen and these past politicians have been like using us to gain their political grip. So now with them like recognizing their youth, I see the future within ZUNDE.
Political commentator Fortune Gwazi said while Zimbabweans are free to form political parties, it will be hard for any party including ZUNDE to change the electoral playing field in Zimbabwe.
Yes, it's still their constitutional right, but for them now to aim that high that they will not participate in political processes until there is electoral reform, it's pitching too high at the moment.
ZUNDE joins many other political parties that have been formed since independence but have failed to dislodge ZANU-PF from power. It remains to be seen how ZUNDE will achieve this feat, given that some of its leaders, like Justice Peraza, cannot come back to the country where they are facing alleged corruption charges. Reporting from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
The African Growth and Opportunity Act is a U.S. trade provision that lets thousands of products from African countries enter the U.S. without paying taxes. The act is due to expire in September. The U.S. Senate recently voted to extend the act for another 10 years. The House of Representatives will soon decide the fate of the act. Critics say the program has only benefited a few sub-Saharan African countries and needs some revisions. Mariama Diallo reports.
When President Barack Obama visited Africa 2 years ago, people were visibly excited. But some local business owners like Sadia Gay in Senegal hoped he'd address the export barriers, which she thought are still too high for small businesses like her clothing design workshop that exports to the United States.
In the textile sector, AGOA brings with it lots of restrictions. Since we signed the agreement, people are always holding meetings left and right. But I believe that we have not been able to do anything real.
VOA spoke with Serigne Alou Diop of ASEPEX, the agency in charge of promoting Senegalese exports, including fisheries, agricultural, and artisanal products.
Today, after 13 to 14 years of being eligible, I don't think Senegal has really benefited from AGOA. Some of it is due to the limited financial capacities of our companies, the quasi-inexistence of cargo flights to the U.S., and the strict rules regarding our products.
According to the U.S. Department of Commerce, the top five AGOA beneficiary countries are Angola, Nigeria, South Africa, Chad, and Gabon. Among other leading beneficiaries is Lesotho, which has one of the largest textile industries with 40 plants mainly run by Asian businessmen. While the program is working for countries like Lesotho, it's not the norm for all the eligible countries.
In its peak year, 2008, was $80 billion. However, 2014, Just last year, it finished the year $23 billion.
Rick Helfenbein is the chairman of the American Apparel and Footwear Association. He says AGOA can do better.
67% was energy related. Where was the other 33%? 20 of the 33% is South Africa. That means what's left, 13% of the 33% in non-energy is coming from 35 countries, underutilized, completely underutilized.
Last year, U.S. import from sub-Saharan Africa decreased by 32%, according to the U.S. Department of Commerce. The reason was mostly due to a 51% decrease in U.S. oil imports from the region. But Orrin Hatch, who heads the Senate Finance Committee, recently praised the trade agreement.
Since AGOA was enacted in the year 2000, trade with beneficiary countries has more than tripled, with the U.S. direct investment growing more than sixfold in that time. The program has helped create more than 2 million jobs.
Hatch, who helped craft the reauthorization language for the new bill, says that to improve on AGOA's past successes, it's important to allow both sub-Saharan Africa and the U.S. to benefit from expanded market access. In Washington, Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Renewed fighting in South Sudan has forced thousands to flee their homes in recent days. Some 650,000 civilians reportedly are without access to aid. Civilians remain caught between government troops and opposition forces. With more than 20,000 people fleeing to UN bases in the northern towns of Malakal and Bentiu over the last few weeks, these sites are becoming overcrowded and intercommunal tensions are escalating, the aid group Doctors Without Borders said. Meanwhile, the rainy season is underway in South Sudan, increasing the risk of diseases like cholera and malaria. The United States condemns the intensified fighting and violence in Unity, Upper Nile, and Jonglei states in South Sudan by the Sudan People's Liberation Army, the armed opposition, and forces led by General Johnson Alani. This fighting has displaced large populations and devastated the lives of civilians. We call on all armed groups to immediately halt offensive actions taken in contravention of the January 2014 Cessation of Hostilities Agreement. Violations of humanitarian norms by all sides are unacceptable, including the outright targeting of already vulnerable civilians, especially women and children, grave human rights abuses, and violations of international humanitarian law. the international community will hold those who perpetrate these serious abuses to account. We call on all sides to give up arms and permit the UN mission in South Sudan to investigate the sites of alleged human rights abuses and other violations of international humanitarian law, and to grant humanitarian workers free, immediate, and unobstructed access to all conflict-affected communities. The human, social, and economic costs of this war have been devastating, and the long-suffering people of South Sudan now will bear the brunt of the long-term consequences of continued fighting. Any damage to South Sudan's oil infrastructure is an additional peril that jeopardizes the future efforts of South Sudanese to rebuild and develop their young nation. These resources belong to all South Sudanese people. The needs of the many have to come before the political ambitions of a few. The United States will continue to work with our partners to ensure a hopeful future for all South Sudanese citizens, and we will continue to condemn those who intentionally put that hopeful future at risk.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.